So again, this service comes from the Church of the Larger Fellowship, and was written by Dr. Tony Larson, and he's actually a minister at Olympia Brown Church in Racine, I believe, and I think Laurie knows him very well. So in the service, or in the sermon here, when you hear the first person spoken, of course, that's Dr. Larson, not me. It's called Tables. Many important things happen around tables. Some of our most important conversations take place there. Maybe it was a restaurant table at which you proposed marriage to the person with whom you are now spending your life. Or it's the dinner table over which you tell someone you love night after night about the things that have gone well that day and the things that haven't. Perhaps it's a coffee table around which you've shared stories and jokes with your friends. And consider the wider world. We have the bargaining table at which opposing sides sit down to work out their differences. We have round tables, which are discussions on important issues in the world around a circular table. Then there's the peace table, which brings enemy nations together who agree to stop fighting and killing one another. When Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin came to Washington to pledge their peace agreement, President Clinton had the special historic desk from the treaty room brought out for the signing. It was the same table that Begin and Sadat had signed on years before. During the negotiations to end the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese argued over the shape of the table, and they finally agreed on a round one so no one would appear to be superior. Then there are tables at home. In your own home, the table is also an instrument to unite people. Perhaps it's the breakfast table that serves as a meeting place from which you and the people you care about express your hopes for the day and get ready to face the world. And at Thanksgiving and other special holidays, you spend a long time at the table, longer than you need to. You've eaten all the turkey you can handle. You could easily get up and go to a living room, or even all of you leave together and go your separate ways. But something keeps you at that table, dirty dishes and all. I've seen it happen. You don't want to leave it because you know inside that a table is an altar of sorts. Holy things can happen there. They've happened before. One of our church members told me how she cut out her first dress on the kitchen table while her mother was making dinner. Another said that the table is where his family discussions occur. It's where homework is done or games are played, where letters are written or artwork created. Secrets have been told, burdens have been lifted, words of forgiveness have been said. All across the table. Hands have reached across and around. Feet have touched underneath. Laughter has erupted all around, and tears have fallen on top of that table. Oh, the stories your kitchen table could tell, the things it has witnessed. You don't think about it usually, but the table is probably the holiest place in your house. And you know, when someone gets sick or has a death in the family, we often go to their house with a casserole. It's not so much that we think they can't cook anymore or can't order out, but a meal is our way of saying, I'm sorry, and I wish I could take the pain away, and I wish I had the right words to say, but I can't and I don't, so please accept this casserole, and they understand. When Craig and I moved into our new house a couple of years ago, one of you did something rather interesting. you made a full supper for us and brought it over at the end of the day for our table, and it was delicious. And we could have ordered pizza or gone out to eat, but this special dinner was such a gift and conveyed so much more than just food that we've never forgotten it. In ancient times, a meal was a symbol of friendship. We shake hands now to signify welcome, but in ancient times you usually did it with a meal. Only friends could share a meal together, so if you invited a stranger to your table, that was in effect making them your friend. To eat food with someone was an act of welcome. Even today it is, when you think about it. When I go to someone's house to visit, they almost always ask me if I'd like something to eat or drink. It's not because they think I'm hungry or thirsty after a long day out in the fields or something like that. It's because offering something to eat, eating something together, even if it's a cracker or a cup of tea, is a symbol of welcome. It's always been. If someone comes into your home and they leave without touching anything, then when they've gone, you have no concrete sign that they were there. But if there are cookie crumbs on your coffee table, or a missing brownie or two, maybe a little less coffee or soda than there had been before, then your home's been changed just a little bit. And your visitor has changed too, because something you gave has gone inside them, has become part of their body. Something from you has become part of them. The food and drink are offered as symbols. They are not given so much to satisfy our hunger as to cement our friendship. This was also true thousands of years ago, because ancient people knew that offering food was how you made friends with others. They would build altars, which were really tables, altars for the gods. And they would offer food on the tables, knowing that to sit at their goddess's table was to be their goddess's friend. Most religions around the world still include food in their rituals. Shintoists offer fruit and vegetables to the kami. Buddhists put a bowl of rice before the statue of Gautama. Sikhs share a special pudding in their temples. Jews ask God to bless bread and wine every Friday night. In our congregation, we have shared coconuts in the Jain tradition and Hindu sweets for Diwali. And in LCUUC's tradition, we've shared many Thanksgivings together. In the early Christian church, people came together for a meal to remember Jesus. By the middle of the second century, they were no longer eating a whole meal, but just sharing a piece of bread and a sip of wine with readings and prayers and a sermon. And eventually, they were only allowed to eat the bread. Only the priest could drink the wine. And then the bread became smaller and smaller until it became a flat, tasteless disc. By the Middle Ages, most people didn't feel worthy to eat even that. Also, the wooden tables that had been used originally for the meal were replaced with stone altars, which were moved farther and farther from the people until they were separated by steps and a railing and even faced the wall, so the priest's back was to the people. The Mass became something to watch, not participate in. But in the beginning, Christians came together for a whole meal. In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 11, verses 27 through 22, he complained about what he had heard about these dinners. So this is Paul. In the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you assemble as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you. When you meet together, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal, and one is hungry and another is drunk. What? Do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you in this? No, I will not. Apparently in the early church, and this is early because the first book of Corinthians was written around the year 50 CE, or about 20 years after Jesus died, when Christians gathered to remember Jesus with a whole meal, the people who were wealthy would bring a lot of food and then not share it with their poorer brothers and sisters. Not only that, they'd get intoxicated on the wine. That's what he's getting at in there. So this disturbed Paul, and rightly so, because it was supposed to be a meal of unity. Everyone brings food, everyone shares. Not, I bring my food for myself. If you don't have enough, too bad. You see, the original celebrations of the Lord's Supper, the original communion services, were potluck dinners. Our church's dinner circles are closer to those early gatherings than our Sunday services. And Paul wanted them to be truly potluck dinners, not just a bunch of people coming together to eat alone. Now, it shouldn't surprise us too much that the early Christian services were meals. After all, the Last Supper was undoubtedly a Passover meal. And we know from the Gospels that Jesus had many meals with the disciples. So having a meal in Jesus' memory was probably a good way to keep him alive in their hearts. But I must admit, I don't usually think of Jesus that way. I think of him as lecturing the multitudes, or healing the lepers, or telling wise parables. I don't think of him as saying, hey, Peter, would you pass the bread and butter this way? Or, great fish tonight, John. But he probably said these things. And he probably revealed who he was as a human being over a table with his friends. That's where he expressed his hopes and probably also his doubts. It's over a table that we usually get to know someone best, and that's why I think the communion table is an important piece of furniture to keep in our church. In this case, I don't know if our up here would be a kind of our communion table, or we may have some opportunity to do something different, but I know there are people who think, how can we have communion in this UU church? Most of us don't believe that Jesus was God. And we certainly don't believe that bread and wine can be magically changed into someone's body and blood. So why don't we get rid of this table or haul it off to the attic to store along with our other historical artifacts, relics of the past but no longer relevant? Well, let me tell you something. I grew up Catholic, as some of you did. When I made my first communion, I understood that the wafer, host, was actually the body of Christ. And since I believed Christ was God, I knew that when I received the wafer, I was receiving God. Only the priest could touch the communion host. If a consecrated host fell on the floor, there was a special ceremony to purify the host and the floor. And there was even a special ceremony on First Fridays where the consecrated host was enshrined in a gold container that was lifted up before the people so we could worship it. This made communion a very vertical thing, something between the individual and God. There was no sense of community from that. Communion between me and God, not communion between me and you. So what started out as a community potluck dinner 2,000 years ago became a very private thing. And what has been a unity meal was no longer recognizable as such. Perhaps the greatest irony is that many churches today do not allow people who are not members to receive communion. Even so-called open communion churches often have a creedal test. if you believe such and such and accept this and that and have faith in this creed, we invite you to communion with us, they say. But in his own life, Jesus ate with everybody. In fact, he caused quite a scandal in doing so. This is from Mark chapter 2, verse 15 and 16. It says, "And as he sat at table, many tax collectors and sinners were sitting with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, 'Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?'" But you see, part of Jesus' whole mission was to bring together the people that others cast off. He ate with open sinners because he had a vision of the realm of God as a great banquet that would be open to all who wanted to come. This was a wide open table. In my mind, that means black and white, rich and poor, gay and straight, even Hindu and Muslim, Buddhist and Jew, all are welcome at the table of unity. We need a big table in our world today, a table open to more than one religion, recognizing more than one path. We need to learn to become companions. Companion is an interesting word. It comes from two Greek words, kom, meaning with, and pan, meaning bread. A companion is literally someone you've had bread with. That's the original meaning of the word. When you share bread with a stranger, that stranger becomes a bread with person, a companion. So symbolically, that's what our big table means. Not only companionship with our friends and the people who know us well, but a willingness to risk getting to know those who seem different from us, people we may be reluctant to get to know. Then there's a closed table. Thought a lot about that when I read about a small town in Louisiana called Welsh. It seems there was a young man there that the town didn't want at their table. His name is John Broussard, a former Air Force medic. One day, John announced on local TV that he was gay and that he had HIV/AIDS. After that broadcast, his Baptist neighbors told him he was going to hell. Local doctors refused to treat him, and people threw rocks at his house. It wasn't only hard on him, but on his family too. "My parents," he said, "went through more rejection by friends in 1 year than they had ever in their entire lives." There was no welcome table there, quite the opposite. But John Broussard decided he would not let the unwelcoming response of his community determine his reaction to it. He started going into every store in town to talk with the sales clerks and the customers. Even when they ignored him, he wouldn't give up. He also started giving talks at his junior high school about HIV/AIDS. And eventually, people began to come around. Kids started listening to his talks, so did some of their parents. People who used to avoid him began to come up and ask how he was doing, what could they do to help. A doctor in a nearby town said he'd try to learn what he could about HIV/AIDS so he could give him medical help. Seventh and eighth graders wrote him letters saying they wouldn't tell anti-gay jokes anymore because now they had a friend who was gay. So sometimes a closed table can become an open one. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about tables and communion is that the world is getting smaller. That's a cliche, of course. Everyone says that. But although the world is getting smaller, we're not getting closer. You'd think we'd be closer if the world's getting smaller. It's almost the opposite. So we don't seem to understand each other better. We're more aware now of what's going on around us, but we're not necessarily more compassionate or understanding as a result. When something happens in one part of the world, we see it flashed instantly on our TV screens, but the people involved are not really at table with us. We keep them out as best we can. Tables can remind us that seeing and hearing, no matter how instantaneously, is not the same as responding with our hearts. And they also remind us that when others close themselves off, as the people of Welsh Louisiana did originally with John Broussard, we don't have to accept that. We can try to change their hearts. When they exclude us from their table, we can still invite them to our own. They will not always accept our invitation. But we will know we made the offer, and that will be enough for an open table.